As it was passing by yet again, I impulsively dropped my hand into the water and grabbed it just ahead of the tail, where its body was thinnest. Its harsh skin afforded such a marvelously good grip that without thinking about what I was doing, I pulled. As I pulled, it jumped, giving my arm a terrific shake. To my horror and delight, the thing vaulted in the air in an explosion of water and spray. For the merest fraction of a second, I didn't know what to do next. The thing was smaller than I, but wasn't I being a foolhardy Goliath here? Shouldn't I let go? I turned and swung, and falling on the tarpaulin, I threw the Mako towards the stern. The fish fell from the sky into Richard Parker's territory. It landed with a crash and started thwacking about with such thunder that I was afraid it would demolish the boat. Richard Parker was startled. He attacked immediately. An epic battle began. Of interest to zoologists, I can report the following. A tiger will not at first attack a shark out of water with its jaws, but will rather strike at it with its forepaws. Richard Parker started clubbing the shark. I shuddered at every blow. They were simply terrible. Just one delivered to a human would break every bone, would turn any piece of furniture into splinters, would reduce an entire house into a pile of rubble. That the Mako was not enjoying the treatment was evident from the way it was twisting and turning and beating its tail and reaching with its mouth. Perhaps it was because Richard Parker was not familiar with sharks, had never encountered a predatory fish. Whatever the case, it happened. An accident. One of those few times when I was reminded that Richard Parker was not perfect, that despite his honed instincts, he too could bumble. He put his left paw into the Mako's mouth. The Mako closed its jaws. Immediately, Richard Parker reared onto his back legs. The shark was jerked up, but it wouldn't let go. Richard Parker fell back down, opened his mouth wide, and full out roared. I felt a blast of hot air against my body. The air visibly shook, like the heat coming off a road on a hot day. I can well imagine that somewhere far off, 150 miles away, a ship's watch looked up, startled, and later reported the oddest thing, that he thought he heard a cat's meow coming from 3 o'clock. Days later, that roar was still ringing in my guts. But a shark is deaf, conventionally speaking. So while I, who wouldn't think of pinching a tiger's paw, let alone of trying to swallow one, received a volcanic roar full in the face and quaked and trembled and turned liquid with fear and collapsed, the shark perceived only a dull vibration. Richard Parker turned and started clawing the shark's head with his free front paw and biting it with his jaws, while his rear legs began tearing at its stomach and back. The shark held on to his paw, its only line of defense and attack, and thrashed its tail. Tiger and shark twisted and tumbled about. With great effort, I managed to gain enough control of my body to get onto the raft and release it. The lifeboat drifted away. I saw flashes of orange and deep blue, of fur and skin, as the lifeboat rocked from side to side. Richard Parker's snarling was simply terrifying. At last, the boat stopped moving. After several minutes, Richard Parker sat up, licking his left paw. In the following days, he spent much time tending his four paws. A shark's skin is covered with minute tubercles that make it as rough as sandpaper. He had no doubt cut himself while repeatedly raking the shark. His left paw was injured, but the damage did not seem permanent. No toes or claws were missing. As for the Mako, except for the tips of the tail and the mouth area, incongruously untouched, it was a half-eaten, butchered mess. Chunks of reddish-gray flesh and clumps of internal organs were strewn about. I managed to gaff some of the shark's remains, but to my disappointment, the vertebrae of sharks do not hold fluid. At least the flesh was tasty and unfishy, and the crunchiness of cartilage was a welcome respite from so much soft food. Subsequently, I went for smaller sharks, pups really, and I killed them myself. I found that stabbing them through the eyes with a knife was a faster, less tiresome way of killing them than hacking at the tops of their heads with the hatchet. Chapter 80. Of all the Dorados, I remember one in particular. A special Dorado. It was early morning on a cloudy day, and we were in the midst of a storm of flying fish. Richard Parker was actively swatting at them. I was huddled behind a turtle shell, shielding myself from the flying fish. I had a gaff with a piece of net hanging from it extended into the open. I was hoping to catch fish in this way. I wasn't having much luck. A flying fish whizzed by. The Dorado that was chasing it burst out of the water. It was a bad calculation. The anxious flying fish got away, just missing my net, but the Dorado hit the gunwale like a cannonball. The thud it made shook the whole boat. A spurt of blood sprayed the tarpaulin. I reacted quickly. I dropped beneath the hail of flying fish and reached for the Dorado just ahead of a shark. I pulled it aboard. It was dead, or nearly there, and turning all kinds of colors. What a catch! What a catch! I thought excitedly. Thanks be to you, Jesus Matsya. The fish was fat and fleshy. It must have weighed a good 40 pounds. It would feed a horde. Its eyes and spine would irrigate a desert. Alas! Richard Parker's great head had turned my way. I sensed it from the corner of my eyes. The flying fish was still coming, but he was no longer interested in them. It was the fish in my hands that was now the focus of his attention. He was 8 feet away. His mouth was half open, a fish wing dangling from it. His back became rounder. His rump wriggled. His tail twitched. It was clear. He was in a crouch, and he was making to attack me. It was too late to get away, too late even to blow my whistle. My time had come. But enough was enough. I had suffered so much. I was so hungry. There are only so many days you can go without eating. And so, in a moment of insanity brought on by hunger, because I was more set on eating than I was on staying alive, without any means of defense, naked in every sense of the term, I looked Richard Parker dead in the eyes. Suddenly, his brute strength meant only moral weakness. It was nothing compared to the strength in my mind. I stared into his eyes, wide-eyed and defiant, and we faced off. Any zookeeper will tell you that a tiger, indeed any cat, will not attack in the face of a direct stare, but will wait until the deer or antelope or wild ox has turned its eyes. But to know that and to apply it are two very different things, and it's a useless bit of knowledge if you're hoping to stare down a gregarious cat. While you hold one lion in the thrall of your gaze, another will come up to you from behind. For two, perhaps 3 seconds, a terrific battle of minds for status and authority was waged between a boy and a tiger. He needed to make only the shortest of lunges to be on top of me. But I held my stare. Richard Parker licked his nose, groaned, and turned away. He angrily battered a flying fish. I had won. I gasped with disbelief, heaved the Dorado into my hands, and hurried away to the raft. Shortly thereafter, I delivered to Richard Parker a fair chunk of the fish. From that day onwards, I felt my mastery was no longer in question, and I began to spend progressively more time on the lifeboat, first at the bow, then, as I gained confidence, on the more comfortable tarpaulin. I was still scared of Richard Barker, but only when it was necessary. His simple presence no longer strained me. You can get used to anything. Haven't I already said that? Isn't that what all survivors say? Initially, I lay on the tarpaulin with my head against its rolled-up bow edge. It was raised a little, since the ends of the lifeboat were higher than its middle, and so I could keep an eye on Richard Barker. Later on, I turned the other way, with my head resting just above the middle bench, my back to Richard Barker and his territory. In this position, I was further away from the edges of the boat, and less exposed to wind and spray. Chapter 81. I know my survival is hard to believe. When I think back, I can hardly believe it myself. My crude exploitation of Richard Barker's weak sea legs is not the only explanation. There is another. I was the source of food and water. Richard Barker had been a zoo animal as long as he could remember, and he was used to sustenance coming to him without his lifting a paw. True, when it rained and the whole boat became a rain catcher, he understood where the water came from. And when we were hit by a school of flying fish, there too my role was not apparent. But these events did not change the reality of things, which was that when he looked beyond the gunwale, he saw no jungle that he could hunt in and no river from which he could drink freely. Yet I brought him food and I brought him fresh water. My agency was pure and miraculous. It conferred power upon me. Proof? I remained alive day after day, week after week. Proof? He did not attack me, even when I was asleep on the tarpaulin. Proof? I am here to tell you this story. Chapter 82. I kept rainwater and the water I collected from the solar stills in the locker, out of Richard Barker's sight, in the 3 50-liter plastic bags. I sealed them with string. Those plastic bags wouldn't have been more precious to me had they contained gold, sapphires, rubies, and diamonds. I worried incessantly about them. My worst nightmare was that I would open the locker one morning and find that all three had spilled, or, worse still, had split. To forestall such a tragedy, I wrapped them in blankets to keep them from rubbing against the metal hull of the lifeboat, and I moved them as little as possible to reduce wear and tear. But I fretted over the necks of the bags. Would the string not wear them thin? How would I seal the bags if their necks were torn? When the going was good, when the rain was torrential, when the bags had as much water as I thought they could take, I filled the bailing cups, the 2 plastic buckets, the 2 multipurpose plastic containers, the 3 beakers, and the empty cans of water, which I now preciously kept. Next, I filled all the plastic vomit bags, sealing them by twisting them shut and making a knot. After that, if the rain was still coming down, I used myself as a container. I stuck the end of the rain catcher tube in my mouth, and I drank. And I drank, and I drank. I always added a little seawater to Richard Barker's fresh water, in a greater proportion in the days following a rainfall, in a lesser during periods of drought. On occasion, in the early days, he dipped his head overboard, sniffed the sea, and took a few sips, but quickly he stopped doing it. Still, we barely got by. The scarcity of fresh water was the single most constant source of anxiety and suffering throughout our journey. Of whatever food I caught, Richard Barker took the lion's share, so to speak. I had little choice in the matter. He was immediately aware when I landed a turtle or a dorado or a shark, and I had to give quickly and generously. I think I set world records for sawing open the belly shells of turtles. As for fish, they were hewn to pieces practically while they were still flopping about. If I got to be so indiscriminate about what I ate, it was not simply because of appalling hunger. It was also plain rush. Sometimes I just didn't have the time to consider what was before me. It either went into my mouth that instant, or was lost to Richard Parker, who was pawing and stamping the ground and huffing impatiently on the edge of his territory. It came as an unmistakable indication to me of how low I had sunk the day I noticed, with a pinching of the heart, that I ate like an animal. That this noisy, frantic, unchewing, wolfing down of mine was exactly the way Richard Parker ate. Chapter 83. The storm came on slowly one afternoon. The clouds looked as if they were stumbling along before the wind, frightened. The sea took its cue. It started rising and falling in a manner that made my heart sink. I took in the solar stills and the net. Oh, you should have seen that landscape. What I had seen up till now were mere hillocks of water. These swells were truly mountains. The valleys we found ourselves in were so deep they were gloomy. Their sides were so steep, the lifeboat started sliding down them, nearly surfing. The raft was getting exceptionally rough treatment, being pulled out of the water and dragged along, bouncing every which way. I deployed both sea anchors fully, at different lengths, so that they would not interfere with each other. Climbing the giant swells, the boat clung to the sea anchors like a mountain climber to a rope. We would rush up until we reached a snow-white crest in a burst of light and foam and a tipping forward of the lifeboat. The view would be clear for miles around, but the mountain would shift, and the ground beneath us would start sinking in a most stomach-sickening way. In no time we would be sitting once again at the bottom of a dark valley, different from the last, but the same, with thousands of tons of water hovering above us and with only our flimsy lightness to save us. The land would move once more. The sea anchor ropes would snap to tautness, and the roller coaster would start again. The sea anchors did their job well. In fact, nearly too well. Every swell at its crest wanted to take us for a tumble, but the anchors, beyond the crest, heaved mightily and pulled us through, but at the expense of pulling the front of the boat down. The result was an explosion of foam and spray at the bow. I was soaked through and through each time. Then a swell came up that was particularly intent on taking us along. This time the bow vanished underwater. I was shocked and chilled and scared witless. I barely managed to hold on. The boat was swamped. I heard Richard Parker roar. I felt death was upon us. The only choice left to me was death by water or death by animal. I chose death by animal. While we sank down the back of the swell, I jumped onto the tarpaulin and unrolled it towards the stern, closing in Richard Parker. If he protested, I did not hear him. Faster than a sewing machine working a piece of cloth, I hooked down the tarpaulin on both sides of the boat. We were climbing again. The boat was lurching upwards steadily. It was hard to keep my balance. The lifeboat was now covered, and the tarpaulin battened down, except at my end. I squeezed in between the side bench and the tarpaulin and pulled the remaining tarpaulin over my head. I did not have much space. Between bench and gunwale there was 12 inches, and the side benches were only 1.5 feet wide. But I was not so foolhardy, even in the face of death, as to move on to the floor of the boat. There were four hooks left to catch. I slipped a hand through the opening and worked the rope. With each hook done, it was getting harder to get the next. I managed two. Two hooks left. The boat was rushing upwards in a smooth and unceasing motion. The incline was over 30 degrees. I could feel myself being pulled down towards the stern. Twisting my head frantically, I succeeded in catching one more hook with the rope. It was the best I could do. This was not a job meant to be done from the inside of the lifeboat, but from the outside. I pulled hard on the rope, something made easier by the fact that holding onto it was preventing me from sliding down the length of the boat. The boat swiftly passed a 45-degree incline. We must have been at a 60-degree incline when we reached the summit of the swell and broke through its crest onto the other side. The smallest portion of the swell's supply of water crashed down on us. I felt as if I were being pummeled by a great fist. The lifeboat abruptly tilted forward, and everything was reversed. I was now at the lower end of the lifeboat, and the water that had swamped it, with a tiger soaking in it, came my way. I did not feel the tiger. I had no precise idea of where Richard Parker was. It was pitch black beneath the tarpaulin. But before we reached the next valley, I was half drowned. For the rest of that day and into the night, we went up and down, up and down, up and down, until terror became monotonous and was replaced by numbness and a complete giving up. I held on to the tarpaulin rope with one hand and the edge of the bow bench with the other, while my body lay flat against the side bench. In this position, water pouring in, water pouring out, the tarpaulin beat me to a pulp. I was soaked and chilled, and I was bruised and cut by bones and turtle shells. The noise of the storm was constant, as was Richard Parker's snarling. Sometime during the night, my mind noted that the storm was over. We were bobbing on the sea in a normal way. Through a tear in the tarpaulin, I glimpsed the night sky. Starry and cloudless. I undid the tarpaulin and lay on top of it. I noticed the loss of the raft at dawn. All that was left of it were two tied oars and the life jacket between them. They had the same effect on me as the last standing beam of a burnt-down house would have on a householder. I turned and scrutinized every quarter of the horizon. Nothing. My little marine town had vanished. That the sea anchors, miraculously, were not lost. They continued to tug at the lifeboat faithfully, was a consolation that had no effect. The loss of the raft was perhaps not fatal to my body, but it felt fatal to my spirits. The boat was in a sorry state. The tarpaulin was torn in several places, some tears evidently the work of Richard Parker's claws. Much of our food was gone, either lost overboard or destroyed by the water that had come in. I was sore all over and had a bad cut on my thigh. The wound was swollen and white. I was nearly too afraid to check the contents of the locker. Thank God none of the water bags had split. The net and the solar stills, which I had not entirely deflated, had filled the empty space and prevented the bags from moving too much. I felt exhausted and depressed. I unhooked the tarpaulin at the stern. Richard Parker was so silent, I wondered whether he had drowned. He hadn't. As I rolled back the tarpaulin to the middle bench and daylight came to him, he stirred and growled. He climbed out of the water and set himself on the stern bench. I took out needle and thread and went about mending the tears in the tarpaulin. Later, I tied one of the buckets to a rope and bailed the boat. Richard Parker watched me distractedly. He seemed to find nearly everything I did boring. The day was hot, and I proceeded slowly. One haul brought me something I had lost. I considered it. Cradled in the palm of my hand was all that remained between me and death. The last of the orange whistles. Chapter 84. I was on the tarpaulin, wrapped in a blanket, sleeping and dreaming and awakening and daydreaming and generally passing the time. There was a steady breeze. From time to time, spray was blown off the crest of a wave and wet the boat. Richard Parker had disappeared under the tarpaulin. He liked neither getting wet nor the ups and downs of the boat. But the sky was blue, the air was warm, and the sea was regular in its motion. I awoke because there was a blast. I opened my eyes and saw water in the sky. It crashed down on me. I looked up again. Cloudless blue sky. There was another blast, to my left, not as powerful as the first. Richard Parker growled fiercely. More water crashed against me. It had an unpleasant smell. I looked over the edge of the boat. The first thing I saw was a large black object floating in the water. It took me a few seconds to understand what it was. An arching wrinkle around its edge was my clue. It was an eye. It was a whale. Its eye, the size of my head, was looking directly at me. Richard Parker came up from beneath the tarpaulin. He hissed. I sensed from a slight change in the glint of the whale's eye that it was now looking at Richard Parker. It gazed for 30 seconds or so before gently sinking under. I worried that it might strike us with its tail, but it went straight down and vanished in the dark blue. Its tail was a huge, fading, round bracket. I believe it was a whale looking for a mate. It must have decided that my size wouldn't do, and besides, I already seemed to have a mate. We saw a number of whales, but none so close up as that first one. I would be alerted to their presence by their spouting. They would emerge a short distance away, sometimes 3 or 4 of them, a short-lived archipelago of volcanic islands. These gentle behemoths always lifted my spirits. I was convinced that they understood my condition, that at the sight of me, one of them exclaimed,
"Oh, it's that castaway with the pussycat Bump who was telling me about. Poor boy. Hope he has enough plankton. I must tell Mumpu and Tompu and Stimpu about him. I wonder if there isn't a ship around I could alert. His mother would be very happy to see him again. Goodbye, my boy. I'll try to help. My name's Pimpu."
And so, through the grapevine, every whale of the Pacific knew of me, and I would have been saved long ago if Pimpu hadn't sought help from a Japanese ship whose dastardly crew harpooned her, the same fate as befell Lampu at the hands of a Norwegian ship. The hunting of whales is a heinous crime. Dolphins were fairly regular visitors. One group stayed with us a whole day and night. They were very gay. Their plunging and turning and racing just beneath the hull seemed to have no purpose other than sporting fun. I tried to catch one, but none came close to the gaff. And even if one had, they were too fast and too big. I gave up and just watched them. I saw 6 birds in all. I took each one to be an angel announcing nearby land. But these were seafaring birds that could span the Pacific with hardly a flutter of the wings. I watched them with awe and envy and self-pity. Twice I saw an albatross. Each flew by high in the air without taking any notice of us. I stared with my mouth open. They were something supernatural and incomprehensible. Another time, a short distance from the boat, two Wilson's petrels skimmed by, feet skipping on the water. They too took no notice of us, and left me similarly amazed. We at last attracted the attention of a short-tailed shearwater. It circled above us, eventually dropping down. It kicked out its legs, turned its wings, and alighted in the water, floating as lightly as a cork. It eyed me with curiosity. I quickly baited a hook with a bit of flying fish and threw the line its way. I put no weights on the line and had difficulty getting it close to the bird. On my third try, the bird paddled up to the sinking bait and plunged its head under water to get at it. My heart pounded with excitement. I did not pull on the line for some seconds. When I did, the bird merely squawked and regurgitated what it had just swallowed. Before I could try again, it unfolded its wings and pulled itself up into the air. Within 2-3 beatings of its wings, it was on its way. I had better luck with a masked booby. It appeared out of nowhere, gliding towards us, wings spanning over 3 feet. It landed on the gunwale within hand's reach of me. Its round eyes took me in, the expression puzzled and serious. It was a large bird with a pure snowy white body and wings that were jet black at their tips and rear edges. Its big bulbous head had a very pointed orange-yellow beak, and the red eyes behind the black mask made it look like a thief who had had a very long night. Only the oversized brown webbed feet left something to be desired in their design. The bird was fearless. It spent several minutes tweaking its feathers with its beak, exposing soft down. When it was finished, it looked up and everything fell into place, and it showed itself for what it was. A smooth, beautiful, aerodynamic airship. When I offered it a bit of Dorado, it pecked it out of my hand, jabbing the palm. I broke its neck by leveraging its head backwards, one hand pushing up the beak, the other holding the neck. The feathers were so well attached that when I started pulling them out, skin came off. I was not plucking the bird. I was tearing it apart. It was light enough as it was, a volume with no weight. I took the knife and skinned it instead. For its size, there was a disappointing amount of flesh, only a little on its chest. It had a more chewy texture than Dorado flesh, but I didn't find there was much of a difference in taste. In its stomach, besides the morsel of Dorado I had just given it, I found 3 small fish. After rinsing them of digestive juices, I ate them. I ate the bird's heart, liver, and lungs. I swallowed its eyes and tongue with a gulp of water. I crushed its head and picked out its small brain. I ate the webbings of its feet. The rest of the bird was skin, bone, and feathers. I dropped it beyond the edge of the tarpaulin for Richard Parker, who hadn't seen the bird arrive. An orange paw reached out. Days later, feathers and down were still floating up from his den and being blown out to sea. Those that landed in the water were swallowed by fish. None of the birds ever announced land. Chapter 85. Once there was lightning. The sky was so black, day looked like night. The downpour was heavy. I heard thunder far away. I thought it would stay at that. But a wind came up, throwing the rain this way and that. Right after, a white splinter came crashing down from the sky, puncturing the water. It was some distance from the lifeboat, but the effect was perfectly visible. The water was shot through with what looked like white roots. Briefly, a great celestial tree stood in the ocean. I had never imagined such a thing possible. Lightning striking the sea. The clap of thunder was tremendous. The flash of light was incredibly vivid. I turned to Richard Parker and said,
"Look, Richard Parker, a bolt of lightning."
I saw how he felt about it. He was flat on the floor of the boat, limbs splayed and visibly trembling. The effect on me was completely the opposite. It was something to pull me out of my limited mortal ways and thrust me into a state of exalted wonder. Suddenly a bolt struck much closer. Perhaps it was meant for us. We had just fallen off the crest of a swell and was sinking down its back when its top was hit. There was an explosion of hot air and hot water. For 2, perhaps 3 seconds, a gigantic, blinding white shard of glass from a broken cosmic window danced in the sky, insubstantial yet overwhelmingly powerful. 10,000 trumpets and 20,000 drums could not have made as much noise as that bolt of lightning. It was positively deafening. The sea turned white, and all color disappeared. Everything was either pure white light or pure black shadow. The light did not seem to illuminate so much as to penetrate. As quickly as it had appeared, the bolt vanished. The spray of hot water had not finished landing upon us, and already it was gone. The punished swell returned to black and rolled on indifferently. I was dazed. Thunderstruck. Nearly in the true sense of the word. But not afraid.
Praise be to Allah, Lord of all worlds, the compassionate, the merciful, ruler of Judgment Day,
I muttered. To Richard Parker, I shouted,
Stop your trembling! This is miracle! This is an outbreak of divinity! This is...
I could not find what it was, this thing so vast and fantastic. I was breathless and wordless. I lay back on the tarpaulin, arms and legs spread wide. The rain chilled me to the bone. But I was smiling. I remember that close encounter with electrocution and third-degree burns as one of the few times during my ordeal when I felt genuine happiness. At moments of wonder, it is easy to avoid small thinking, to entertain thoughts that span the universe, that capture both thunder and tinkle, thick and thin, the near and the far. Chapter 86.
Richard Parker, a ship!
I had the pleasure of shouting that once. I was overwhelmed with happiness. All hurt and frustration fell away, and I positively blazed with joy.
We've made it. We're saved. Do you understand, Richard Parker? We're saved!
I tried to control my excitement. What if the ship passed too far away to see us? Should I launch a rocket flare? Nonsense.
It's coming right towards us, Richard Parker. Oh, I thank you, Lord Ganesha. Blessed be you and all your manifestations, Allah Brahman.
It couldn't miss us. Can there be any greater happiness than the happiness of salvation? The answer, believe me, is no. I got to my feet. The first time in a long time I had made such an effort.
Can you believe it, Richard Parker? People, food, a bed. Life is ours once again. Oh, what bliss.
The ship came closer still. It looked like an oil tanker. The shape of its bow was becoming distinct. Salvation wore a robe of black metal with white trim.
And what if?
I did not dare say the words. But might there not be a chance that father and mother and Ravi were still alive? The Simsum had had a number of lifeboats. Perhaps they had reached Canada weeks ago and were anxiously waiting for news from me. Perhaps I was the only person from the wreck unaccounted for.
My God, oil tankers are big.
It was a mountain creeping up on us.
Perhaps they're already in Winnipeg. I wonder what our house looks like. Do you suppose, Richard Parker, that Canadian houses have inner courtyards in the traditional Tamil style? Probably not. I suppose they would fill up with snow in winter. Pity. There's no peace like the peace of an inner courtyard on a sunny day. I wonder what spices grow in Manitoba.
The ship was very close. The crew better be stopping short or turning sharply soon.
Yes. What spices? Oh, my God!
I realized with horror that the tanker was not simply coming our way. It was, in fact, bearing down on us. The bow was a vast wall of metal that was getting wider every second. A huge wave girdling it was advancing towards us relentlessly. Richard Parker finally sensed the looming juggernaut. He turned and went, woof, woof, but not dog-like. It was tiger-like. Powerful, scary, and utterly suited to the situation.
Richard Parker, it's going to run us over. What are we going to do? Quick, quick, a flare! No, must row. Or an oarlock. There! Huff! 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 Huff!
The bow wave pushed us up. Richard Parker crouched, and the hairs on him stood up. The lifeboat slid off the bow wave and missed the tanker by less than 2 feet. The ship slid by for what seemed like a mile of high black canyon wall, a mile of castle fortification with not a single sentinel to notice us languishing in the moat. I fired off a rocket flare, but I aimed it poorly. Instead of surging over the bulwarks and exploding in the captain's face, it ricocheted off the ship's side and went straight into the Pacific, where it died with a hiss. I blew on my whistle with all my might. I shouted at the top of my lungs. All to no avail. Its engines rumbling loudly and its propellers chopping explosively underwater, the ship churned past us and left us bouncing and bobbing in its frothy wake. After so many weeks of natural sounds, these mechanical noises were strange and awesome and stunned me into silence. In less than 20 minutes, a ship of 300,000 tons became a speck on the horizon. When I turned away, Richard Parker was still looking in its direction. After a few seconds, he turned away too, and our gazes briefly met. My eyes expressed longing, hurt, anguish, loneliness. All he was aware of was that something stressful and momentous had happened, something beyond the outer limits of his understanding. He did not see that it was salvation barely missed. He only saw that the Alpha here, this odd, unpredictable tiger, had been very excited. He settled down to another nap. His sole comment on the event was a cranky meow.
I love you.
The words burst out pure and unfettered, infinite. The feeling flooded my chest.
Truly I do. I love you, Richard Parker. If I didn't have you now, I don't know what I would do. I don't think I would make it. No, I wouldn't. I would die of hopelessness. Don't give up, Richard Parker. Don't give up. I'll get you to land. I promise. I promise.
Chapter 87. One of my favorite methods of escape was what amounts to gentle asphyxiation. I used a piece of cloth that I cut from the remnants of a blanket. I called it my dream rag. I wet it with seawater so that it was soaked but not dripping. I lay comfortably on the tarpaulin, and I placed the dream rag on my face, fitting it to my features. I would fall into a daze, not difficult for someone in such an advanced state of lethargy to begin with. But the dream rag gave a special quality to my gaze. It must have been the way it restricted my air intake. I would be visited by the most extraordinary dreams, trances, visions, thoughts, sensations, remembrances. And time would be gobbled up. When a twitch or a gasp disturbed me and the rag fell away, I'd come to full consciousness, delighted to find that time had slipped by. The dryness of the rag was part proof. But more than that was the feeling that things were different, that the present moment was different from the previous present moment. Chapter 88. One day we came upon trash. First the water glistened with patches of oil. Coming up soon after was the domestic and industrial waste. Mainly plastic refuse in a variety of forms and colors, but also pieces of lumber, beer cans, wine bottles, tatters of cloth, bits of rope, and surrounding it all, yellow foam. We advanced into it. I looked to see if there was anything that might be of use to us. I picked out an empty corked wine bottle. The lifeboat bumped into a refrigerator that had lost its motor. It floated with its door to the sky. I reached out, grabbed the handle, and lifted the door open. A smell leapt out so pungent and disgusting that it seemed to color the air. Hand to my mouth, I looked in. There were stains, dark juices, a quantity of completely rotten vegetables, milk so curdled and infected it was a greenish jelly, and the quartered remains of a dead animal in such an advanced state of black putrefaction that I couldn't identify it. Judging by its size, I think that it was lamb. In the closed, humid confines of the refrigerator, the smell had had time to develop, to ferment, to grow bitter and angry. It assaulted my senses with a pent-up rage that made my head reel, my stomach churn, and my legs wobble. Luckily, the sea quickly filled the horrid hole, and the thing sank beneath the surface. The space left vacant by the departed refrigerator was filled by other trash. We left the trash behind. For a long time, when the wind came from that direction, I could still smell it. It took the sea a day to wash off the oily smears from the sides of the lifeboat. I put a message in the bottle. Japanese-owned cargo ship Simsum, flying Panamanian flag, sank July 2nd, 1977, in Pacific, 4 days out of Manila. Am in lifeboat. Bai Patel my name. Have some food, some water, but Bengal tiger a serious problem. Please advise family in Winnipeg, Canada. Any help very much appreciated. Thank you. I corked the bottle and covered the cork with a piece of plastic. I tied the plastic to the neck of the bottle with nylon string, knotting it tightly. I launched the bottle into the water. Chapter 89. Everything suffered. Everything became sun-bleached and weather-beaten. The lifeboat, the raft until it was lost, the tarpaulin, the stills, the rain catchers, the plastic bags, the lines, the blankets, the net, all became worn, stretched, slack, cracked, dried, rotted, torn, discolored. What was orange became whitish orange. What was smooth became rough. What was rough became smooth. What was sharp became blunt. What was whole became tattered. Rubbing fish skins and turtle fat on things, as I did, greasing them a little, made no difference. The salt went on eating everything with its million hungry mouths. As for the sun, it roasted everything. It kept Richard Parker in partial subjugation. It picked skeletons clean and fired them to a gleaming white. It burned off my clothes and would have burned off my skin, dark though it was, had I not protected it beneath blankets and propped up turtle shells. When the heat was unbearable, I took a bucket and poured seawater on myself. Sometimes the water was so warm it felt like syrup. The sun also took care of all smells. I don't remember any smells, or only the smell of the spent hand-flare shells. They smelled like cumin. Did I mention that? I don't even remember what Richard Parker smelled like. We perished away. It happened slowly, so that I didn't notice it all the time. But I noticed it regularly. We were two emaciated mammals, parched and starving. Richard Parker's fur lost its luster, and some of it even fell away from his shoulders and haunches. He lost a lot of weight, became a skeleton in an oversized bag of faded fur. I too withered away, the moistness sucked out of me, my bones showing plainly through my thin flesh. I began to imitate Richard Parker in sleeping an incredible number of hours. It wasn't proper sleep, but a state of semi-consciousness in which daydreams and reality were nearly indistinguishable. I made much use of my dream rag. These are the last pages of my diary.
Today saw a shark bigger than any I've seen till now. A primeval monster 20 feet long. Striped. A tiger shark. Very dangerous. Circled us. Feared it would attack. Have survived one tiger. Thought I would die at the hands of another. Did not attack. Floated away. Cloudy weather, but nothing. No rain. Only morning grayness. Dolphins. Tried to gaff one. Found I could not stand. RP weak and ill-tempered. Am so weak, if he attacks I won't be able to defend myself. Simply do not have the energy to blow whistle. Calm and burning hot day. Sun beating without mercy. Feel my brains are boiling inside my head. Feel horrid. Prostrate body and soul. Will die soon. RP breathing but not moving. Will die too. Will not kill me. Salvation. An hour of heavy, delicious, beautiful rain. Filled mouth, filled bags and cans, filled body till it could not take another drop. Let myself be soaked to rinse off salt. Crawled over to see RP. Not reacting. Body curled, tail flat. Coat clumpy with wetness. Smaller when wet. Bony. Touched him for first time ever. To see if dead. Not. Body still warm. Amazing to touch him. Even in this condition, firm, muscular, alive. Touched him and fur shuddered as if I were a gnat. At length, head half in water stirred. Better to drink than to drown. Better sign still. Tail jumped. Threw piece of turtle meat in front of nose. Nothing. At last half rose. To drink. Drank and drank. Ate. Did not rise fully. Spent a good hour licking himself all over. Slept. It's no use. Today I die. I will die today. I die.
This was my last entry. I went on from there, endured, but without noting it. Do you see these invisible spirals on the margins of the page? I thought I would run out of paper. It was the pens that ran out.
Chapter 90.
I said, "Richard Parker, is something wrong? Have you gone blind?" As I waved my hand in his face. For a day or two, he had been rubbing his eyes and meowing disconsolately, but I thought nothing of it. Aches and pains were the only part of our diet that was abundant. I caught a Dorado. We hadn't eaten anything in 3 days. A turtle had come up to the lifeboat the day before, but I had been too weak to pull it aboard. I cut the fish in 2 halves. Richard Parker was looking my way. I threw him his share. I expected him to catch it in his mouth smartly. It crashed into his blank face. He bent down. After sniffing left and right, he found the fish and began eating it. We were slow eaters now. I peered into his eyes. They looked no different from any other day. Perhaps there was a little more discharge in the inner corners, but it was nothing dramatic. Certainly not as dramatic as his overall appearance. The ordeal had reduced us to skin and bones. I realized that I had my answer in the very act of looking. I was staring into his eyes as if I were an eye doctor, while he was looking back vacantly. Only a blind wild cat would fail to react to such a stare. I felt pity for Richard Parker. Our end was approaching. The next day I started feeling a stinging in my eyes. I rubbed and rubbed, but the itch wouldn't go away. The very opposite. It got worse, and unlike Richard Parker, my eyes started to ooze pus. Then darkness came, blink as I might. At first it was right in front of me, a black spot at the center of everything. It spread into a blotch that reached to the edges of my vision. All I saw of the sun the next morning was a crack of light at the top of my left eye, like a small window too high up. By noon, everything was pitch black. I clung to life. I was weakly frantic. The heat was infernal. I had so little strength, I could no longer stand. My lips were hard and cracked. My mouth was dry and pasty, coated with a glutinous saliva as foul to taste as it was to smell. My skin was burnt. My shriveled muscles ached. My limbs, especially my feet, were swollen and a constant source of pain. I was hungry, and once again there was no food. As for water, Richard Parker was taking so much that I was down to 5 spoonfuls a day. But this physical suffering was nothing compared to the moral torture I was about to endure. I would rate the day I went blind as the day my extreme suffering began. I could not tell you when exactly in the journey it happened. Time, as I said before, became irrelevant. It must have been sometime between the 100th and the 200th day. I was certain I would not last another one. By the next morning, I had lost all fear of death, and I resolved to die. I came to the sad conclusion that I could no longer take care of Richard Parker. I had failed as a zookeeper. I was more affected by his imminent demise than I was by my own. But truly, broken down and wasted away as I was, I could do no more for him. Nature was sinking fast. I could feel a fatal weakness creeping up on me. I would be dead by the afternoon. To make my going more comfortable, I decided to put off a little the intolerable thirst I had been living with for so long. I gulped down as much water as I could take. If only I could have had a last bite to eat. But it seemed that was not to be. I set myself against the rolled-up edge of the tarpaulin in the middle of the boat. I closed my eyes and waited for my breath to leave my body. I muttered, "Goodbye, Richard Parker. I'm sorry for having failed you."
I did my best. Farewell.